This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to The Joy of Text, a monthly podcast about Judaism and sexuality. I'm Sarah Rosner Lawrence. Coming up, a listener question about in vitro fertilization prompts a discussion about fertility challenges.
Like, people sort of like don't realize how traumatic an experience this can be for couples, especially when it continues on and on.
Then we'll hear from Instagram influencer Elizabeth Savetsky about the recent #RealLoveRealLoss campaign and her work to raise awareness about pregnancy loss and infertility.
Every time I am at the doctor's office and have to fill in my medical history with the number of pregnancies I've had and the number of live children I have, how it is this terrible trigger that brings back all of the painful emotions from when I lost my pregnancies.
And of course, the final word. Stay tuned for The Joy of Text right after this quick word from our sponsor.
Hi, my name is Rabbi Eliezer Lawrence, and I'm a certified Mohel. I serve the New York metropolitan area and work with Jewish families and conversion candidates of all identities, affiliations, and orientations, both in the Orthodox community and beyond. My practice is built on ethos of safety and spirituality for baby and guests. I support the Joy of Text because I believe that Torah and sexual health are not mutually exclusive, and both are strengthened when examined through a shared lens. For more information about me or my practice, you can visit my website at familymohel.com, or you can give me a call at 201-694-1801. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast and B'Sha'at Tova.
This listener question is kind of multi-layered and a little bit complex, but I think it'll be a good jumping off point for an important conversation.
Great. And now's a good time also to say we love getting your questions. We love getting your comments. Please. Yes. Keep them coming.
Absolutely. Okay, here's the listener question. My spouse has a rare chromosomal condition whereby he is physically fine in every way, except that when we try to conceive a child, it will result in miscarriage the majority of the time, and a pregnancy that makes it past the first several weeks has a significantly increased chance of severe challenges in the baby, according to a genetic counselor. Most people in our position who have the means to opt for IVF to have biological children. While it can often take several IVF cycles to get one or two chromosomally normal embryos, when you do get them, you then have more confidence that you will carry and deliver a healthy baby. I am wondering what the Jewish view is of using IVF to have children. If permitted or encouraged, is a Jewish couple obligated to do it as much as they can afford to? It's quite costly, for example, around $25,000 to $30,000 per round, including the necessary genetic testing. And what should they do if it results in more normal embryos than they had in mind to use? Any guidance on what to do with unused embryos? Possible choices are to allow another couple who cannot create their own to adopt the embryo, donate the embryo to science, or have it destroyed. Another question, some fertility clinics will actually reveal the genders of the available embryos and allow the patient to choose which one is implanted. I assume the patient could also choose not to know. What is the Jewish view of how this should be handled?
Oh, a lot of easy questions.
Yes. Yeah, so I'll just introduce this by saying there are amazing questions there, and we will address some of them in an extensive way, perhaps as the year goes on or next year. There's no way we could address all of them here, but it felt to us like this was sort of asking a bigger question, which is, as couples face infertility, like the impact of that on so many levels.
Right.
And so we're going to try to address that just from one perspective.
Yeah,
today.
We're going to look at like the couple's perspective and the challenges that they face. I think the question about what's their level of obligation to do this, you know, and what's not asked directly there, but I will tell you what I get a lot is questions about what if certain treatments have to happen on Shabbos and what type of, you know, allowances could there be. Some of those other issues about, you know, fetal reduction and gender selection and extracting the semen, I mean, any one of those is an episode in itself, so we're just going to bracket them.
And also how much one has to put oneself into financial distress,
right,
in order to have provo.
Right. Like, I mean, I'll talk about that a bit because let's start with the issue, I think, about like whether this is an obligation to do this. We should also say right at the outset, yes, that, you know, people dealing with infertility, it is enormously expensive, and it's a real issue that health insurance companies, you know, by and large, do not cover it. Some of the larger ones do, little pieces of it. Outside of the U.S., it's just standard that health insurance companies cover infertility treatments. So that's, I think, has to be really recognized and acknowledged, and that's a tremendous financial burden, on couples. So in terms of Pu'er Vu and the mitzvah, the Torah doesn't, it's almost, as far as I know, the total consensus of the poskim, that there's no obligation to do it in any way other than the natural way. So nobody should feel that they have a halachic obligation to do this. At the same time, halacha totally recognizes the profound human desire to have children, you know, outside of any halachic obligation. And the importance of having children. I will say that if a couple does this, there's also almost a complete consensus that they do fulfill the mitzvah of Pu'er Vu. It doesn't matter that they used artificial means to help them with this.
Including donor eggs?
Oh, so I'm glad you asked that. So, right, if it's using everybody's own, you know, biological material, then yes. There's an interesting question that if a man's semen is used without his knowledge and unintentionally to impregnate a woman, does he fulfill Pu'er Vu? But if
we could do a lot of conversations about that.
Well, you know, and I'm sure it happens let's say somebody also donates semen and, you know, it's not in a relationship with the person and sort of not involved in the process. But if somebody is having semen taken from them specifically to impregnate his wife, you know, then everybody agrees that that's Pu'er Vu. If it's another woman's egg, you know, again, this gets to the fact that halachically, the mitzvah is really the man's mitzvah. If it's another woman is the surrogate, or it's another woman's egg, that really wouldn't affect whether the man fulfills the mitzvah. If it's another man's semen, then it would. But certainly if it's, you know, the Pu'er Vu, it's not an obligation. They'll fulfill it if it's the man's semen, even if it's not. Many poskim say in a case of adoption or a case of, you know, some other man's semen, there's a partial fulfillment of Pu'er Vu of having and raising a child, even if it's not fully your biological child. So from that perspective, you know, they definitely fulfill the mitzvah, but nobody should feel an obligation to undergo, you know, this from a halachic point of view.
Right, because I think people have to do realize, like, how potentially destructive some of these treatments can be on a relationship. We do people a service if we realize what a trauma, I'll use the word trauma, often this is for relationships. The Resolve, the National Infertility Association, talks about there being a 30% increase in divorces after 5 or 10 years after people trying to start having children, mm-hmm. a higher level of divorce than others. So it's not a little thing. It's a big thing. And I think the more we can accept it as such, the more helpful we will be for couples.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, as I said, the questions I get all the time, which I find is where, you know, an additional stress that could be in theory added by halacha is Shabbos questions. And I was trying to remember, I mean, you know, there's many things you could imagine. It's a certain, you know, because there's so much to do in terms of hormones to take and
injections.
Testing to do and injections and seeing, you know, checking where you are to know whether it's
blood
now
tests.
The right time and mm-hmm. the blood test. And often, you know, even you can try, however hard you try, something's got to get done on Shabbos. Like, you know, oh, we just did the test and it's clear that now is the right time and we have to go in and, you know, do the implantation on Shabbos.
Implantation
on
Shabbos. Implementing to that.
Right. Or, you know, we need to do another test and we really have to do it now. And I get those questions all the time. I was trying to remember some specific ones. So I actually called up somebody who's asked me multiple questions. And I said, if you wouldn't mind, can you remind me what I said? I say, you never have to worry with me about confidentiality because I forget everything right after. So I said, could you remind me about what the specifics were? So here's just two cases from this person. And they're interesting because they show you, like, not everything is as obvious. One was the fertilized egg. They implanted it.
Let's and call it an embryo.
Anyway, they had implanted it, but, you know, it was not yet clear that it was going to take.
They had put it in, but it hadn't implanted.
Right. Or it implanted, but it wasn't. Anyway, it was all very questionable what was going to happen. Apparently, at that point, it's just called a chemical. miracle pregnancy. That's the term. And they needed, and they took a blood test right before Shabbos, and they said it's still not clear if this is going to work or not. And we well, let's take another test either on Shabbos or on Sunday to see if it's really taking. So you would say, okay, well, you don't have to take a test on Shabbos because you're not going to do anything. It's just going to determine whether it's taken. But the man who spoke to me, he was, you know, he was speaking to me on behalf of his wife, and he said, you know, she is just so anxious and so nervous and so, you know, about what's going to happen. Can we do the test on Shabbos just to alleviate her state of anxiety and her panic? So it's really interesting because it wasn't to do any particular treatment. It was just to get information. You know, and I said, well, look, first of all, you know, mental state and that stress cannot be good for the fetus. You know, that cannot be helpful in terms of, you know, allowing that to really. And in general, halacha, you know, there's a category, and I feel this is a really important category, and I'm surprised it's not used more when people, poskim deal with this, is by Shabbos, there's a category called mitzta'er, which is like, you know, suffering, but it's not only physical, anguish, suffering, pain, and that allows you to do pretty much anything that is not a direct biblical violation, that category of mitzta'er. So it seems, I said, first of all,
it allows you to, in contrast to, like in other words, mitzta'er is in contrast to
There are other things that give allowance, like if it's for the sake of a mitzvah, you can do something, but if it's only like a doubly removed rabbinic type of a thing. So, you know, you could say having a baby is a mitzvah, but that's only if you, not even a direct rabbinic violation, a, you know, doubly removed rabbinic violation.
How about cholev? Which is, I know that's the one everybody talks about, that you're allowed to break Shabbat because you want to be able to keep future Shabbatot,
well, okay,
right?
So if it's a risk of life, then of course, then you can break Shabbat for, you know, even a biblical violation. What's really interesting, this gets to, you know, almost these questions about the right to life and when does life begin and so on. What's the status of a fetus that has not yet implanted or not yet fully implanted? Would that go under saving a life to allow for a biblical violation? But when it's not in that case of saving a life, you know, so a chola allows for rabbinic
life. A chola is somebody who's sick. Like in this case, it would be the woman, perhaps.
Exactly.
If you look at her as if she there's something wrong with her and she's
exactly. Imagine
sick.
Somebody in bed with a migraine, somebody who has a serious case of a flu. You know, what can you do to get them medicine, to treat them, and so on? So there, generally, you're allowed to do certain types of things that otherwise would be rabbinically forbidden. But there are limits. I don't want to go into all the details, but there are limits. Whereas mitzta'er allows you to do anything that's short of a biblical violation. Like there are no limits.
That's amazing. Yeah. Like, I would never have thought that would be a more
permissive category. Right. And it is shocking. I really can't explain it. But I do want to say, when I've spoken to people about why not use the category, I know I have a colleague who's in the Hasidic world, and he says, I don't use the category of chole or mitzta'er. I said,
chole,
really?
Sick and mitzta'er
is anguish or suffering. I said, okay, let's go through them. Why don't you use the category of chole? I mean, you know, this person, I mean, it's not like you're initiating, right, treatments on Shabbos. You know, they're in the middle of some cycle. It's preserving their health. It's ensuring that, you know, something's going on with their body. And he said, well, like, you know, there's no chola he sees as a sense of a certain, like, urgency of preserving health. And this type of a thing says, in theory, if you don't do it now, you can do it at another time. So he's not insensitive. I mean, in the end, he winds up permitting a lot of things, which I'll get to. But he basically says, I don't see how technically it's chola, because this is a type of a treatment that can be done some other time. So it's not like a state that the person all of a sudden got sick with the flu.
And so I like to just jump in and say what's beautiful about this chola, sick versus mitzta'er versus anguish, is that part of what happens to a couple, either the man or the woman, kind of depending where the infertility may be landing, is thinking of themselves as broken.
Right.
And that is such a terrible way for people to enter into this situation. And it's so natural for people to start feeling like they're broken, like something's wrong with them. Like, what's wrong with my body that I can't produce sperm, or that I can't produce the right eggs, or I can't seem to conceive? And I mean, I see it with the women. I feel like men just don't articulate things as much. But I think as much as we can kind of shift that way of thinking from the fact that there is something wrong with you, that you are a broken human being in some way, to, you know, you have just hit really bad luck, and this is so sad.
Right.
And, you know, this is something you need support to get past, mm-hmm, but not mm-hmm. that you're broken. So right. I want to throw that in.
No, I think that, and I also, to me, like, I think that chola, you know, do we want to be labeling people as ill, as sick as a result? Whereas Mitzrayim just describes a very real, profound, you know, psychic, emotional reality. I mean, I say if people are not spending $20,000 and undergoing these invasive, horrific types of process, if they're not in a lot of psychic pain, and the Gemara speaks about how a woman's right to have a child and what it means to be child. I mean, for God's sake, it's in the Torah. Every single one of our mothers is like, what does a Rachel say to Yaakov? She says, give me children, and if not, meita anochi. I'm like, I'm dead. So, it's really describing and acknowledging, like validating, the psychic reality. So to me, besides that it's very, halachically powerful, it's very appropriate.
The anguish category.
Yeah, it's a validating and just an accurate one. It looks like you want to say something.
Right, yeah. I'm really happy that you brought up the issue of the foremothers of the Imahot, because I think especially just coming out of the holidays, that can sometimes be a time that people who are experiencing infertility, that can be such a painful, emotionally difficult time to be getting together with family, to be in synagogue a lot, to really just be surrounded by kids. And I do think that there's something really powerful about the way that our holiday liturgy at this time of year tends to really focus on the
Imahot.
Yeah,
on the Imahot. It's the liturgy and the living, both. It's like the liturgy and the shul and the family. Like, you're just totally inundated in the Chagim.
Right, but the irony is that, on Rosh Hashanah, it's all about, Sarah being remembered and having a child and Chana and so on. But then how much is that sensitivity raised at the communal level? Like, when is the last time, even forget Rosh Hashanah, when is the last time when we read any of those stories in Bereishit, particularly, with Yitzchak and Rivka, right, which opens, that they're praying for a child and so on, have you heard a rabbi get up and say, I want to talk about infertility and I want to talk about people in our community that are struggling with this?
Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, yes, that they do that quite a bit. But I think you're right. That's
you're
not
right.
necessarily true everywhere else.
That is true.
You got to give credit where credit is due.
That is true. Maybe I don't go to enough sermons after you went to that's the problem. But I think it's the sensitivity. It's twofold. It's one is explicitly raising it and talking about it, and it's just so much in the Torah, and then it's like this shameful thing that never gets spoken about from the pulpit. And then Sarah, it's what you said, you go to a bris, right? You go, and everybody is like felling over, the child and childbirth and so on. And how are the people who are there who have been struggling for 5 years and not having a child, how are they feeling, And I've been to a few brises, I think particularly here at the HIR, from my students at Chove, people where we're raising the sensitivity, where they explicitly acknowledge that in a way that I find is, it doesn't fix it. Nothing's going to fix it, but it acknowledges it, So, right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. So, I mean, generally my approach is the Mitzrayim category, and I do want to say one last thing about this. The rabbi spoke to did say that he will, case by case, if there's a real case of anguish or whatever, categorize something as Mitzrayim, but he's much more reluctant to do so than it would seem that I am. My approach is sort of like what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said, who is extremely lenient about health issues on Shabbos, and he says, don't say I'm being lenient about Shabbos, I'm being strict about preserving life. So that's sort of the approach I take here. I'm being strict about people's mental well-being and about the ability to have children and bringing children into the world. But I said to him, okay, so what do you do at the end? So I want to actually tell you what he said, because I think it's really important for our listeners to know. There's an organization in Brooklyn called A-Time, A-T-I-M-E, two words, and basically they, nonprofit, you don't have to be in Brooklyn, you can be anybody, you call them, and you're dealing with a fertility issue, they will work out that they'll get you to get it at a different hospital that's more convenient for you to get to on Shabbos. They'll send a non-Jew to your house to take a blood test. They will manage all of the details to deal with, minimizing any halachic issues that can come up. So this couple that I was talking to about the blood test, I was, you know, can they take a cab to the hospital for the blood test on Shabbos? They reached out to this Eitam and they sent a non-Jew who took the blood test in their home on Shabbos. So people should be aware that there are amazing, you know, selfless resources organizations and available. Resources to help couples.
That's amazing. I just want to also add one thing before we wrap this up, which is that if you are a couple who's listening to this or you know somebody, one of the things that I feel like people really need to pay attention to is the state of their relationship, their sex life, their relationship, because that can really go down the drain with this. If you're only having sex when the blood test tells you have to, or if you're feeling terrible about yourself. And there's different ways to handle this. One way is to create a fertility-free time zone that works, I feel like, very well for couples where, you know, either after a few months you decide you're taking a month off, or you every month or two you take a few days where that is just fertility as much as you can gets off your plate, and you go back to having sex when you want to and the way you want to, and you make time to have conversations, because this is so fraught for so many couples. And really kind of paying attention to your relationship, both the sexual part of your relationship and the personal part, is so important, because while you're struggling to have a child, you don't want to lose the other relationship in your life. And that it is so common. And reaching out for help, like maybe going to see a couples therapist, even if you don't, just as you're starting on the pathway, you know, just do it kind of l'yetzer bitachon, like to make sure that things don't kind of spiral out of control, that you guys have the support and the help that you need to do it, is just so important. Because sometimes, you know, you get so focused on this one issue that everything else around it starts to sort of fall apart, and that is the last thing you want to happen when you're looking at infertility issues.
Well, I mean, I see how emotional you are. You must have dealt with a lot of pain
people who are dealing with it, it's a trauma. I really do feel like this is a trauma, and people don't always get the credit for, like, people sort of like don't realize how traumatic an experience this can be for couples, especially when it continues on and on, and you see relationships fall apart because of this, and that is really something we don't want to see. Right. So,
and what you didn't mention, or I don't think I heard you mention, is also what does it mean when sex has to be based on, let me check where my chemicals are right now, and we have to do it tonight, and everything. Right. It removes any spontaneity, not only spontaneity, like it's not coming through the fun and the emotional connection. It's all coming almost as a medical thing that has
to
get done.
Exactly. It makes sex no longer like an erotic, fun, connecting experience, and and it's like medical at that point.
Right. I think the message is I want to encourage, you know, rabbis and communities to talk about it more, to surface it more, to be aware about how much of Jewish community is around family, and that we have to be sensitive about the people that so many people are struggling with this silently. So I want to really encourage that to become much more of a communal agenda. What are your last thoughts, Batsheva?
Take care of yourself and take care of your relationship, and don't let that fall by the wayside as you are dealing with this issue.
And know that there are rabbis and resources out there to help you. And sex therapists.
And sex therapists.
Coming up, our conversation with Elizabeth Savetsky. But first, a word from our sponsors.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
Today, we are so excited to be joined by Elizabeth Savetsky, Instagram fashion influencer and Jewish activist. She has been featured in and written for publications like The Forward, The Jerusalem Post, and Forbes for her Zionism and support of Israel. Most recently, though, she has been advocating awareness about pregnancy loss and fertility issues with her hashtag Real Love, Real Loss campaign online, encouraging women to share their experiences with pregnancy loss and infertility issues. So we are so, so excited to have you. My first question is going to be maybe a little bit silly, but could you give us a little bit of insight into what it is you do? Like, what does it mean to be an influencer on Instagram for those of us who are not as, you know, tech savvy in the 21st
natives.
Century?
Right. It's so funny because, you know, these terms didn't exist, you know, 5-10 years ago. So I always joke, I'm like, what is an influencer? Am I under the influence, honey? You know, it's just such this uncharted territory. And my parents still really haven't figured out what I actually do for a living. So it's a very normal question. So basically what I do is I share my life essentially with my Instagram audience. And I post content. It's usually in the form of pictures with captions. And then I also post video content throughout my day that will just live on my page for 24 hours, whereas the photos and the captions will live on my page permanently. And I share whatever I am promoting, whether it is my personal causes and activism or my partnerships with brands. And the way that I actually make money is I work with different brands to promote their products in an organic way, just by me living my life and endorsing and incorporating their products into my life. It's become like a very organic way to advertise. And so a lot of brands would prefer to work with somebody like me than like a famous, untouchable celebrity, because it's more accessible and attainable. And my audience feels like they know me. We're in this relationship together. And so it's just much more personal.
So you originally started doing fashion, or specifically accessories. And then somewhere along the way, you shifted to sort of Israel Judaism. And that's even before the infertility, which is what we're going to really focus on today. But what created that shift?
So about a year ago, or maybe it was a little longer, maybe a couple of years ago, I started feeling just really unfulfilled by the Instagram world. And I saw that creating this breeding ground for jealousy. And it was just a lot of showing off and only presenting the good and not showing the full picture of someone's life. And it just made me feel really icky. And I was tired of taking pictures of my outfits and tagging the products and, you know, just feeding into this consumer-driven culture. And I thought to myself, well, I have this platform that I've created that I've spent so much time and energy building, and I have this audience here, and I could really do something amazing with it. And, you know, it's all fun to promote fashion, and that will always be a part of who I am. But I just saw such an opportunity to really go deeper. And my audience has a very high emotional quotient, and they were open to me sharing deeper passions, and they were very receptive to it. And I think that because it's this uncharted territory, the social media world, I think, you know, I didn't know what would work, and they didn't know what would work, and we're all kind of just figuring it out together.
That sounds like a really amazing organic process. So just to jump to the fertility issues for a few minutes, when was the first time you shared about fertility struggles on your Instagram account? And what were some of the thoughts that kind of went into that decision for you?
So it was actually very impulsive, which is very much my personality. My husband always tells me to rein it in. I'm always just shooting from the hip. What can I say? So I had just had my first ectopic pregnancy.
In a sentence or two, can you just explain what an ectopic pregnancy is? Not everybody may know that.
So an ectopic pregnancy is when the embryo implants in the fallopian tube instead of in the uterus. And it's extremely dangerous because if the embryo continues to grow, the fallopian tube will rupture, and it will ultimately kill not just the baby, but it will kill the mother. So it's a very critical, urgent situation that has to be remedied, rectified right away. So I had an ectopic pregnancy this past year. I actually had two ectopic pregnancies back to back, but after the first one was when I began to share on social media what I was struggling with. And I guess my thought process was, I'm sitting here on my couch just in this sea of loneliness and sadness, feeling like nobody has ever felt the pain that I was feeling. And my followers think that I have this glamorous, beautiful, perfect life. And I felt like an obligation to say there's more to the story. And I also felt like if I was feeling this way, then maybe other people had felt this way, and I could lean on them and they could lean on me, and it could become a community of support. And this all went through my head in about 2 seconds before I went on my Instagram stories and just started talking. And I just was crying, and I just opened up. And my husband is a surgeon, and he happened to be in the operating room at the time. And he came out of the OR a couple hours later and his had like, you know, 25 text messages. And he's like, "What did you do, Lizzie?" He's like, "What have you done?" And I was like, it was the most satisfying thing, in the sense that immediately after I started posting, I was getting flooded with messages from women telling me that they either could relate to my story, or they were inspired by my strength, and were supporting me and showing me love. And it was just like, wow, it was this aha moment of, wow, maybe this is a conversation that needs to start.
So, but then you continued, this became a thing, correct?
Yes. So, after that first situation happened, I ended up getting pregnant again, and, I found out it was another ectopic pregnancy in the same tube.
Elizabeth, I just have to interrupt to tell you, like, I'm listening to you and I just want to give you a hug. And the best I can do here is give you a virtual one.
Thank you.
So I'm doing that.
You're so sweet. I'm really like, it's crazy to when you get to a place where you can talk about these things, and it's like this narrative you tell, and it's not that you stop feeling it. You know, every time that I tell somebody, it definitely, it reopens the wound a bit, because I think it's something that it just never fully heals. But, you know, you can tell the story and try to put the wall up, but the emotion is still just right there, you know?
Right.
Yeah, no, I think that's really, really important.
So I'm going to try not to break down. So I ended up having a second ectopic pregnancy in the same tube, and it was 3 months later. I couldn't believe it. And I decided, of course, to go back on my Instagram stories and share again. So what actually happened at that point was I had to have an emergency surgery to take out my fallopian tube because it ruptured. And I said to my husband, right as I was about to go under the anesthesia, I said, "I want you to go on my Instagram stories and I want you to tell my followers what is happening, because I said they deserve to know. I want them to be in the loop on this." And he went on when I was in surgery and gave my Hebrew name so everyone could daven for me. And it was really like, I feel like it gave me so much purpose with the pain. Like I said, this wound will never heal, but if there's something good that can come from it, then, you know, I'm happy to focus on the positive as much as I possibly can. And then I wish that the story ended there, but sadly, after that, got pregnant again 3 months later and miscarried at 10 weeks. And, you know, I sat with the pain of all of that for about 6 months before the idea to come up with the Real Love, Real Loss movement, which we just founded, launched.
Okay, so you just alluded to the hashtag Real Love, Real Loss. So can you tell us a little bit more about how that got started? What was the impetus behind that? Did you partner with anyone else on that?
So yes, I actually, Sharon Mazel, who is the co-author of the What to Expect series, is a friend of mine. I met her at a Passover program where she was speaking, and she asked me if I would join her on social media to do a pregnancy loss and infertility Q&A about 3 weeks ago. And so when we were doing that, we were just flooded with questions. And after a week of answering, we realized that we were never going to be able to answer everything. And this is obviously a discussion that needs to be had, and the dialogue needs to be open. And so in the process of that Q&A, I just happened to post a line about how every time I am at the doctor's office and have to fill in my medical history with the number of pregnancies I've had and the number of live children I have, how it is this terrible trigger that brings back all of the painful emotions from when I lost my pregnancies. And when I shared that, there were so many women that could relate and they felt the exact same way. And so I said, we have to do something with these numbers. We have to take these numbers back, because these are not just numbers, but these are our children. And whether they came to live in the world or not, we have love for them. And it's such a hard thing to explain to people because it's an invisible loss. And so I wanted to incorporate the words real into the sharing, because even though you can't see it, it is so real. And the loss is so real. And the love that we have is eternal. And so I came up with the idea. And within a week, I had got together a group of fellow female Instagrammers who were willing to go public with their numbers and wanted to be a part of it. And we decided to launch during the 9 days, because we thought that the period of mourning leading up to Tisha B'Av was a good time for us to all share our pain and open up and band together in solidarity. And so we went live during that time, and it kind of took off. It exploded more than we could have possibly have imagined. And I think there were so many women out there that were just sitting, waiting for an opportunity to open up, and we gave it to them.
So is this particularly a Jewish group?
So the group of women that joined together was all Jewish women. And we weren't intentionally targeting just Jews, but just from a personal perspective, it felt like the right time to do it for us.
I understand. What type of change are you hoping to see, more broadly speaking?
The number one goal that I have with this movement is to destigmatize pregnancy loss. I think that there is so much shame and guilt associated with infertility and pregnancy loss. We feel like as women, we're failing. We can't control our body, and we somehow end up blaming ourselves. And I would like to see the stigma be removed, and I would like to see the community support be stronger. I know that some people have different boundaries with how much they're willing to share, and it's okay to not have to be as open as necessarily as I am, but to know that there is an opportunity for you to open up if you choose to.
And is there anything else that you feel like the Jewish community can do to be more helpful on this issue?
I've been so impressed with what I've seen from the Jewish community just in the past year. I know at my synagogue on the Upper East Side, KJ, they had a women's challah bake. And actually, they invited men as well, because this is something that men go through as well, which I think is also important to note, even though it's not happening to their body, it's happening to their child. And so I was very impressed that the synagogue invited men as well. And anyone who wanted to share, shared. A lot of people didn't share, but they were just there to maybe feel less alone or to show support for their friends. And I've heard of different synagogues doing similar initiatives. I've also heard of this coming more to the forefront in the Jewish community, which I think is great. I think we could always be doing more. I'm glad that we took the opportunity to take to social media with this message. I don't think it had been done on such a impactful level before.
Thank you. I mean, I think that's huge to be able to do that and to create a community. I want to go back for a minute to the men's issue, because, you know, my sense, well, from what I understand, 50% of infertility is male-based. And my sense is that women experience it in a much more traumatic type of a way than men do. But I've also heard from men who feel that they're invisible in this, because the conversation is about women, men who themselves are struggling with infertility, you know, and it also goes to issues of like male virility. So it's not the same for men as it is for women, but I'm wondering about what your thoughts are about that.
I have a lot to say about the men's role and the men's emotions in pregnancy loss and infertility. I think that it's actually as much shame and guilt as the women feel. I think it's equally, if not harder, on the men, because all men want at the end of the day is to want their wives to be happy. I fully believe that that is their number one goal. And so if they feel like they're not able to fulfill their wife's happiness because of their own biological issue, or if they don't know how to properly support their wife, if it's her body that's having the issue, you know, it becomes this really complicated situation to navigate, and people really aren't talking about it enough. I think you really have to go out of your way to seek the resources to get help, and on an emotional level, as a man. And I think most men are honestly not brave enough to do that. I think if it was more, readily accessible, if there was more resources and there's more conversation happening about it and shame was put aside, then I think, you know, it would cause tremendous growth.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to share with our audience, before we end?
So if you would like to join the Real Love, Real Loss movement, is an ongoing movement. And to join, you simply go to my Instagram page, which is at Elizabeth Savetsky, S-A-V-E-T-S-K-Y. And you go to my highlights. And on my main page, there is a section of highlights. And there's one that says Real Love, Real Loss. And if you click on it, you can screenshot the blank form where you fill in your own number of pregnancies and your number of living miracles. And you can fill it in and share it on your own Instagram story or Instagram feed. We use this as a way to acknowledge that the souls of our unborn children are forever loved, and their presence is forever felt within us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for being with us.
It was great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Elizabeth.
My absolute pleasure.
Coming up, the final word. But first, a quick word from our sponsor.
With over 125 musmachim in the field, Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is committed to training a new generation of modern Orthodox rabbis. Jason, you're a rabbi in training. What's your perspective?
It was precisely the musmachim of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah that drew me to the yeshiva. The tremendous diversity of work that they're engaged in and the underlying love of and commitment to the Jewish people really inspires me.
Thanks, Jason. If you'd like to apply or schedule a visit, go to yctorah.org.
So each episode at the end, we do a final word. We once started with, you know, Dov and I coming up with the final word. Last season, we used you guys for the final word. This episode feels a little bit different to us. And so, Sarah?
So for this episode, we would love to invite all of you, our listeners, to share any reflections, any personal stories you have about infertility or pregnancy loss. This is really a topic where we want to be hearing from you in a very real way. So if anyone has any thoughts, reflections, personal stories that they'd like to share, please write them in. Additionally, I do just want to end with a couple of important resources for people to be aware of. If any of our listeners are struggling with infertility or pregnancy loss, there are a few great organizations that are helping to provide both emotional support and sometimes financial support. So there are organizations like Yesh Tikva. We actually interviewed the founder on a different episode, so you can check that out. There's an organization called Hasida and another organization called the Jewish Fertility Foundation, all of which offer emotional support, resources, groups for people struggling with this. And there's also an organization called Nechama Comfort, which helps support families going through the trauma of miscarriage and infant loss, and offers counseling, support groups, and trainings for clergy members in dealing with this.
And I mentioned an organization in Brooklyn called A Time, which will help deal with halachic challenges that come up.
And there's Bonei Olam, which also helps with the financial support.
Great.
Wonderful.
Perfect.
This episode of The Joy of Text was recorded by Mike Kelly, produced and edited by Max Hollander, and is a project of the Lindenbaum Center at YCT. If you have questions or comments you'd like to share with us, you can do so anonymously at www.thejoyoftext.org. The Joy of Text is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, or any podcast app. If you like what you hear, show your support for us by giving us a 5-star rating, and stay up to date with our latest episodes and live events by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram.